Boyd and Baker along if they're looking for something to do. He's making a nuisance of himself. He's aware of this, but he can't help it. It's not Maya calling or Ayers. It's Rupert. Huck. Rupert? You been drinking yet today? Rupert asks. No, Huck says. Not yet. His eyes graze his trusty bottle of Flor de Caña up on the shelf. Is he going to need it? Or is Rupert about to invite him to meet for lunch at Miss Lucy's, an invitation Huck just might take him up on? You remember talking the other day about Paulette Vickers? Yes, Huck says warily. The Flor de Caña, then. He brings the bottle down to the counter. She and her husband were arrested over on St. Croix. You know how Doug Vickers has a sister there? FBI, 2, 3 cars pull into Wilma Vickers' driveway in Frederickstead, and Paulette and Doug get led away in handcuffs. This reliable? Huck asks. Sadie went to school with Wilma, Rupert says. Wilma called Sadie herself. She has a little boy. Parents went to jail. Did they say why? Huck asks. What were they charged with? Conspiracy to commit fraud, Wilma said. Real estate fraud. Financial fraud. Rupert pauses. The guy they were in business with, and the invisible man, too, were doing laundry. Laundry? Huck says. They were cleaning money, Rupert says. Head honcho had a yacht, Bluebeard, and Wilma told Sadie that she knows for certain that boat used to pull into Cruz Bay with a hold full of cash. From guerrilla groups in Nicaragua, Wilma said. And the Marxists in Cuba and Argentinian soccer stars trying to avoid taxes and God knows who else. And Paulette and Douglas Vickers were helping them. When Huck hangs up with Rupert, he calls Agent Vasco but is shuttled immediately to her voicemail. It's Saturday, so maybe she's off duty. But who is he kidding? She's probably waist-deep in the Vickers morass. Huck has known the Vickerses for 20 years. Not well. He's never been invited to their home, never done any direct business with them, but he knows them. Croft must have made them an offer they couldn't refuse. They must have thought they would never get caught. Huck understands what it's like to live here as a local person and see the big boats roll in and watch the enormous villas go up and wonder, why them and not me? Maybe Paulette let herself get into a compromising spot with her family's business. God knows, real estate is risky everywhere. Huck could call some of Leanne's friends, Deary and Helen come to mind, and ask what they've heard. But it's possible that what they heard came from Sadie via Wilma as well. And it's possible that Deary and Helen haven't heard a thing, but will start jabbering as soon as they realize it's a topic of interest. The Vickerses got mixed up with Russell Steele and his boss, Todd Croft, and they were helping to launder the money. Huck's next instinct is to call Irene. He's been looking for a reason, and now he has one. Paulette and Doug Vickers arrested on St. Croix. That much he could share. The rest of it, the laundering and Bluebeard, that all sounds suspiciously like gossip. Still, Huck feels the seed of fear that has been in his gut since Rosie died start to grow. Russ was involved in illegal and dangerous business dealings. Guerrillas in Nicaragua? What Huck wants to know is if he or Maya, or Irene, will somehow be implicated in a crime. We didn't know anything, Huck thinks. Surely the FBI realizes this. Huck has done nothing wrong. Maya has done nothing wrong, and Irene has done nothing wrong. They're innocent. But does that mean they're safe? Getting Paulette and Doug Vickers can't possibly be the FBI's endgame, Huck thinks. They want to find Todd Croft. And Paulette will sing. Of this, Huck is certain. She has her child to think about. From this perspective, maybe Irene would be intrigued by the news, possibly even happy to hear it. They're tracking down answers. What were Croft and Russell Steele doing? Where was all that money coming from? No, it will not make Irene happy, Huck decides. It will make her agitated. especially since all they can do until they get official word from Agent Vasco is speculate. And so Huck decides not to tell Irene until he's had a conversation with Agent Vasco. Huck sets the Flor de Caña back up on the shelf. He heads out onto the deck to have a cigarette. He imagines Irene lying on the beach in Little Cinnamon, thinking about little Elton Petrushki, or about how cold it is back in Iowa City, or about what she's going to make for dinner. But she will not be thinking about Paulette Vickers sitting in an interrogation room and giving the FBI who knows what kind of information about her husband. Huck's silence is a gift. Irene is sure to find out at some point. Hell, maybe she'll find out tomorrow. But at least she has today in peace. At least she has right now. Baker. Baker is so excited after their meeting and tour at the Gift Hill School that he texts Anna from the parking lot.
Found a school for F. They ran assessments. He can start kindergarten now. Very advanced, they said. Happy to have him, and he loved it.
Bye, Maya calls out. She's staying at the school to hang out with friends, and then someone's mother is taking them to town.
Thank you, Maya, Baker says.
Thank you, Maya,
Floyd says, waving like a maniac. Then he turns to Baker.
Daddy, how do we know Maya?
Oh, Baker says.
Floyd is probably confused because Maya introduced Floyd to the head teacher, Miss Phaedra, as her sort of nephew, a phrase that elicited an expression of surprise and suspicion from Miss Phaedra. Apparently, the phrase didn't get past Floyd either. Baker was glad Maya threw the sort of in there because it could be explained any number of ways. They wouldn't have to tell Miss Phaedra that Floyd is, in fact, Maya's actual nephew, the son of Maya's brother, Baker. Sometimes Baker wishes Floyd weren't so advanced.
She's our friend, Baker says.
Not a lie.
I like her, Floyd says. I like the Gift Hill School. Why are there two Fs?
No idea, buddy, Baker says.
He checks that Floyd's seatbelt is fastened, then heads for home. He doesn't hear back from Anna until 2 days later. Wednesday.
K, the text says.
K? Baker thinks. He hadn't expected a fight, necessarily, or even a debate, but he had anticipated something more than just K. They're talking about Floyd's education. Baker was armed with the school brochure and the notes he'd taken in the margins, and he has the website for backup, as well as his own impressions, which he'd spent the past 2 days organizing into a sales pitch. The school is nurturing, but not indulgent, inclusive, tolerant, and forward-thinking. Anna will love all of this. The sky is the limit for Floyd. The classes are small, and they have an Island as Classroom initiative that gets the kids outside studying nature and history and Caribbean culture. But Anna doesn't care. Anna is relocating to Cleveland, learning the ropes at a new hospital, meeting her colleagues, reviewing protocols, buying furniture, and maybe even getting excited for Louisa to become pregnant. Baker tries not to feel like he and Floyd have been brushed off, forgotten. He doesn't bother telling Anna that he also got good news during the visit to the Gift Hill School. He'd received a job offer. The upper school, Miss Phaedra said, desperately needed someone to coach basketball and baseball, as well as do some administrative work for the athletic department. She mentioned this because Baker was so tall and fit-seeming, the seeming being key, and she wondered if maybe he had any background in either sport and might want a chance to get involved in the community, seeing as how he was new to the island. It was like she'd read his mind. Baker said that he did indeed have some background in both sports. He'd played basketball and baseball in high school and in college at Northwestern on the intramural level.
Which means, essentially, that I haven't used my skills in almost 10 years. I've been waiting for Floyd to be old enough so I could coach his teams.
The job does come with a stipend, and the hours would be after school during the respective seasons, Miss Phaedra says.
I'd love to be able to pass your name on to the head of school, and she can talk with you more about it. It's exactly what Baker is looking for, and yet he doesn't commit right away because he still has to go back to Houston for the auction this coming weekend. There's a quiet but persistent voice in Baker's head telling him that it's crazy, and worse, irresponsible, to move to the Caribbean with Floyd. He came down here for one reason only, and that's Ayers. But Ayers is with Mick, and Ayers was clear that she wouldn't even entertain the possibility of a relationship with Baker until he had a job or an opportunity here on St. John. The whole thing is risky. Baker can leave Houston, take the job at Gift Hill, and move here, but Ayers might still stay with Mick. The evening that Anna responds with, K, Irene comes home from work with some fresh Wahoo steaks from her charter. She grills them for Baker and Floyd, and because Cash is out somewhere, it's just the three of them eating dinner on the deck. It's nice. Irene is in a good mood. Her frame of mind seems better now that she's working on Huck's fishing boat, though she's not her old self by any means. Baker tells her that Floyd liked the school, but he doesn't say anything about the job offer yet. He reminds his mother that he and Floyd are headed back to Houston on Friday for the auction. Right, Irene says, though it's clear she's forgotten about it. But you're coming back, yes? Yes, Baker says. I think so. I mean, yes. He wants to sound definitive, but the truth is, he's not sure. He's packing everything they brought down, just in case. When, Irene says, when will you be back? I don't have return tickets yet, Baker says, though I can get them, of course, at a moment's notice. I have to figure some stuff out when I get to Houston. What to do about the house, my car, that kind of thing. Of course, Irene says. No one expects you to drop everything and move down here. Though that's what I did. She laughs. At her own crazy spontaneity, maybe. And that's what your brother did. Where is Cash tonight? Baker asks. He suddenly gets a bad feeling. Cash didn't come back after Treasure Island. Did he go somewhere with Ayers? Out to dinner? This is what Baker has privately feared about Cash and Ayers working together, that they would become chummy, that Cash would, somehow, manage to charm her. He had an incident on the boat today, I guess, Irene says. Passenger got drunk and Cash was called on to help get the girl home. Turned out the girl had a friend that Cash knew, from that restaurant you both like so much? La Tapa, Baker says. That must be it, Irene says. And I think he went out with the friend, something like that. Baker pushes his chair away from the table. Was it Ayers, Mom? Is he out with Ayers? It wasn't Ayers, Irene says. She throws Baker an exasperated look. You boys, honestly. No, it was some other name. British, unusual. Tilda, Baker says. Yes, Irene says. He went out with Tilda. Who's Tilda? Floyd asks. A friend of your uncle's, Irene says. Baker can't describe his relief. He tousles Floyd's hair. You want some ice cream, buddy? They have red velvet cake at the Starfish Market. Baker puts Floyd to bed, then decides to turn in himself, mostly because there's nothing else to do. Cash is still out, and Baker has no other friends. If he were at home in Houston right now, he would smoke some weed and crash out in front of the TV. He needs to catch up on Game of Thrones, but he can't watch that with Irene around. His phone rings. This, he thinks, will be Anna, just getting home from work at 9 o'clock at night. He steels himself. It would be just like Anna to have glanced at his text distractedly and responded with, K, but then, after running the whole thing past Louisa, suddenly have a list of objections. Baker should have texted Louisa. But his display says, Ayers. Ayers? He says. Hey. Her voice sounds funny. Sad, trembling, like she's been crying. Are you busy? Not at all, he says. I just put Floyd to bed so I can talk. What's up? There's a pause. Can you get out? Is Cash there?
Or your mom to watch Floyd?
Yeah. Cash is out, but my mom is here.
Baker stands up and checks himself in the mirror. He hasn't shaved, or showered for that matter, unless swimming in the pool counts as a shower, since the day he went to Gift Hill, Monday. He does have a nice tan now, but he looks like a Caribbean hobo. Do you want to meet somewhere?
Can you just come here, to my place? Ayers asks. There's something I want to talk to you about.
Your place?
Fish Bay, Ayers says. It'll take you 15 minutes if you leave right now.
Right now? Baker says. And before he can explain that he needs to shower and change, she's giving him directions.
Unlike the rest of the island, Fish Bay is flat and really dark. Ayers said she lived past the second little bridge on the left, but Baker would have missed her house if he hadn't caught a flash of green, her truck, out of the corner of his eye. She's standing in the doorway, backlit, hugging herself. He doesn't need to feel bad about not showering, he sees. She's still wearing her Treasure Island uniform, and her hair is wild and curly.
Hey, he says, you okay?
She moves so that he can step past her, inside. Her place is small, cute, bohemian. There's a tiny kitchen with thick ceramic dishes on open shelves. There's a papasan chair, a bunch of houseplants, a glass bowl filled with sand dollars, and a gallery wall of photographs from places all over the world, the Taj Mahal, the Great Pyramids, the Matterhorn. Ayers is in every picture. In many, she's a kid.
Have you been to all these places? Baker asks.
Story for another day, she says. Come sit.
Baker picks a spot next to Ayers on a worn leather sofa draped with a tapestry. There's a coffee table with three pillar candles sitting in a dish of pebbles, and lying across the pebbles is a joint.
Are they going to smoke?
Would you like a glass of water? Ayers asks.
Maybe in a minute, Baker says. Why don't you tell me what's going on?
Ayers folds her legs underneath her. How is it possible that even when she looks awful, she's beautiful?
This morning,
she laughs,
which now feels like 3 days ago.
She picks up the joint and lifts a barbecue lighter off the side table, then seems to think better of it and sets both down.
It's been a very long day.
Some days are like that, Baker says. Start at the beginning.
Last night, Mick told me he had to go to St. Thomas to get restaurant supplies today, Ayers says. Whatever, I found it a little strange, but I didn't question it too much.
She throws her hands up.
Anyway, then this morning, I saw him on the ferry with Bridget.
Baker makes a face like he's surprised. But he's not surprised. He knew Mick would screw it up. He actually wishes Cash were here to listen to this.
Baker leans in. You're kidding.
Not kidding. I saw them sitting together and I was pissed, livid, suspicious.
I bet.
So I sent him a text telling him never to call me again.
Baker spreads his palms against the cool, cracked leather of the sofa. This is real? He didn't fall asleep in bed next to Floyd? Ayers is telling him exactly what he's been waiting to hear, only much sooner than he had hoped. Her timing couldn't be better.
Then Cash and I had this weird, awful thing happen at work.
Yeah, I heard, sort of.
This girl got really drunk, and I thought she'd tanked while snorkeling. We stopped the boat, I dove off, your brother dove off, this other kid who's probably going to be in the Olympics dove off. It was a total circus. And in the end, the chick was in the head, changing out of one inappropriate suit into a second, even more inappropriate suit, and this was all before we even got to Yost. The girl continued to drink and then puked off the side the whole way home.
Ayers sighs.
And I left your brother to handle it, because guess who was waiting for me at the dock?
Mick, Baker says,
and he suspects that maybe this story isn't going to have the ending he wants it to.
Mick, Ayers says, he just left here a little while ago, right before I called you. We broke up.
You broke up? Baker says. He's afraid to go back to feeling optimistic. What did he say? Why was he with Bridget?
He said they bumped into each other. Unplanned. A coincidence. She was headed over to St. Thomas to get a tattoo of the petroglyphs.
Okay, Baker says.
I just got a tattoo of the petroglyphs a few weeks ago, Ayers says.
She holds out her ankle so Baker can see the tattoo. It's a curlicue symbol in dark green.
We're hardly the only two people in the universe with a petroglyph tattoo. Rosie had one. But still, I was chafed.
Understandably, Baker says.
Mick says they only talked for a couple of minutes. Then Mick took Gordon, that's our dog, his dog, up to stand at the bow, and he didn't see Bridget again.
Do you believe him?
I don't want to believe him, Ayers says, but I do.
You do?
I do.
So, why did you break up?
Two reasons, Ayers says. Both are secrets that I'm keeping from him. One is this project that I'm working on. I can't tell him about it, and I can't tell you about it yet either. Maybe in the future, once I'm finished, but not right now.
Secret project, Baker says. I won't ask.
Please don't, Ayers says.
She seems to shrink under her Treasure Island t-shirt, and when she gazes at him, her eyes appear robbed of their pigment. They are very, very pale blue.
The second reason is that I have feelings for you.
For me?
For you, Ayers says. I haven't been able to stop thinking about you.
You haven't? Baker says.
She shakes her head and presses her lips together like she's embarrassed.
So, wait, Baker says.
Is this really happening? Him and Ayers?
Does she want him to kiss her? Does she want him to, finally, make proper love to her?
Baker can't find the words to ask. He's too overwhelmed. But it turns out it doesn't matter.
Ayers stands up, takes his hand, and leads him to her bed. He wakes up in the middle of the night, 4:20 a.m., his phone says. Ayers is naked in bed next to him. He's in love. He's beyond in love. But he has to get out of there. He can't have Floyd waking up and finding his dad gone. Baker eases out of bed and uses the bathroom. He sees a cloth-bound book balanced on the edge of the sink. Ayers's journal? Baker is, of course, tempted to open it and read Ayers's innermost thoughts, presumably about how she's stuck with crappy cheater Mick, but can't get Baker Steele out of her mind. However, back when Baker was in college, he read his girlfriend Trinity's diary and all hell broke loose. That was why they'd split. Trinity had called it a devastating breach of personal trust.
If you learn one thing from me, Baker Steele, she'd said, I hope it's never to read a woman's private thoughts without her express permission. No matter how tempting, she'd added. And oh yes, it will be tempting.
It is tempting. The journal with the red floral cover, demure and innocent with the look of a colonial-era recipe book. But Baker leaves it be. In the end, Trinity taught him a lot. He must remember to hit her up on Facebook and thank her. Back in the bedroom, he runs a finger down the length of Ayers' spine, and she shivers awake and opens one eye.
You leaving?
I have to, he whispers. Floyd.
Okay, she says.
Baker clears his throat. And, you remember that I'm leaving tomorrow for Houston? I have that thing on Saturday, but I'm coming right back, so you don't have to worry.
What day? Ayers asks. What day are you coming back?
Baker does a quick calculation. The benefit auction is Saturday night. Sunday, he's on cleanup duty. He needs at least 2 additional days to get the move organized, maybe 3. Honestly, he could use a week, but now that this has happened, all he can think about is how to get back here as quickly as possible. But then again, he has a life to dismantle. Floyd's medical records need to be transferred. To where? Baker needs to forward his mail. To where? And figure out what to do about his income taxes. There's stuff, Wednesday, he says. Thursday.
Wednesday or Thursday? She asks.
Thursday, he says. Week from today.
I'm working at La Tapa Thursday night, she says. Come by after work. We can celebrate your move.
He kisses her temple. You got it, he says. He puts his clothes on and runs both hands through his hair. Oh, by the way, the chick who got drunk on your boat was a friend of Tilda's. Ayers rolls over and squints at him.
Really?
Yeah, that's what my mother told me Cash said. I guess Cash and Tilda went out last night.
They did? Ayers says, sitting up.
Yeah, Baker says, I think so.
He wonders if hearing this bothers Ayers for some reason. She smiles. They're perfect for each other.
She falls back into her pillows.
When you get back, we can double date.
Great, Baker says sardonically.
Although actually, it sounds like fun.
The theme for the Children's Cottage Benefit Auction is Monopoly. This was Debbie's idea. She was in charge of dreaming up something to top Oh, the Places You'll Go, which was last year's theme. Although Baker was skeptical about the appeal of Monopoly, it evoked nothing so much as the rainy afternoons of childhood, trapped in a never-ending game of being sent to jail, paying other people rent, and eventually going bankrupt due to real estate failures, the execution is brilliantly done. Baker has dressed up as Rich Uncle Pennybags, in a vest with a pocket watch, and people are chattering with anticipation as they leave the school parking lot. Free parking signs abound, which is cute, even though parking is always free at the Children's Cottage. The event is being held in the school gymnasium, built back in 2000 by one of the owners of the Houston Rockets, but the board of directors, naturally, have created a path that takes attendees through the school so that they can see where their donations will be going. Baker, with Ellen at his side, walks through the reading nook filled with picture books, the numbers room with boxes of manipulatives, the science room where kids study birds' nests and leaves and different kinds of rocks, the social studies room festooned with flags of the world, and last and most popular, the water table room. They then pass through the courtyard with the outdoor playground into the gym, which has been transformed into a Monopoly board for the evening. At the front table, everyone picks up a plastic top hat and mustache on a stick. Each stick has a number printed on the back. It doubles as an auction paddle and proceeds to one of the tables, all of which are named for Monopoly properties and sheathed in tablecloths of the corresponding colors. Baker and his school wives are, naturally, at Boardwalk, with a tablecloth of Columbia blue. The centerpiece is a flower sack money bag filled with pebbles and holding a bouquet of gold dahlias. The photo booth is decorated to look like the jail square, so once Baker's friends choose seats, he suggests they get their pictures taken, then go find glasses of the evening's signature cocktail, the Chance Card, which is a lurid orange. They're being served by Vicky Stiles, who likes to expose her cleavage whenever she can.
That was a good choice, Becky says. The Chance Cards are being served by the community chest.
Baker loves his school wives. How will he ever leave them? The event swims along. People drink, eat hors d'oeuvres, bid on silent auction items. Baker really wants to get Floyd tickets to the first Texans game, but then he remembers that he's not going to be around for it. Wendy wants them all to chip in on a house in Galveston in May, but Baker won't be here for that either. He needs to tell his friends about his plans, and soon. The only person who knows is Ellen. Standing in the strobe-lit school gym surrounded by people he has known for years, and even Psycho Mandy in her little black dress with her satin Justin Verlander team jacket over top seems endearing tonight. Baker has a hard time believing that he was in Ayers' apartment only 2 days earlier. He has switched worlds. Which one of them is real? He could easily make the argument that this world is real. This is Houston, a real place. The Children's Cottage is a real school. Baker is a part of this community. He is known. He's Floyd's dad. No one misses Anna, though they all know that she's a big deal, if not a particularly hands-on mother. Baker's friends are real friends, there when he needs them. He's giving up a lot by leaving. His house, his autonomy. There's a way in which moving to St. John feels like regressing. He'll be back living with his mom and brother. All of this is on one side of the scale, and Ayers is on the other. Dinner is served. It's boardwalk food, which sounds iffy but ends up being delicious. Jumbo hot dogs with a variety of toppings, skinny truffle fries, and Mexican street corn. Then the live auction starts, and Baker zones out, thinking he'll tell Debbie, Becky, and Wendy his plans after the auction but before the dancing. They'll be upset initially, but then one of them will request "We Are Family" from the DJ, and they'll all cluster together to dance, and all the married parents will be jealous. Nothing new there. Baker perks up only when the auctioneer announces a super special item, added at the last minute by an anonymous donor. It's 1 week in a villa on St. John with 180-degree views over the Caribbean Sea. 9 bedrooms, dual-level pool, private beach and shuffleboard court, outdoor kitchen, and the use of 2 2018 Jeeps, July or August dates only. Ellen nudges Baker's leg under the table. "This is you?" He gives the slightest of nods. The bidding is robust. It starts at $5,000 and skyrockets from there, $10,000, $15,000, $20,000. July or August is the perfect time of year to escape the beastly heat of Houston. And when Baker ran the idea past Irene and Cash, they'd agreed that July or August would be an ideal time to take a break from St. John and fly to Door County, Irene, and Breckenridge, Cash. $25,000. $30,000.
Jeez, Baker, Ellen murmurs.
It's Nanette's husband bidding, Wendy says. Oil.
Against Beanie O'Connor's grandmother, Becky says. Oil.
$35,000. $40,000.
That's going to buy a lot of manipulatives, Debbie whispers.
$45,000. $50,000. Going once, going twice. Sold for $50,000.
Are you going back? Ellen asks. For good?
Baker sighs. He hasn't even told Ellen about his night with Ayers. He hasn't told anyone. I am, he says.
Good for you, Ellen says.
The auction is over. The DJ gets warmed up with Celebrate, and all of Baker's friends go to the ladies' room, leaving him sitting at the table alone. First order of business on getting back to St. John, find some male friends, other than Cash. When the ladies reappear, they envelop Baker in a group hug. Wendy is crying. Baker gives Ellen a quizzical look, and she shrugs as if to say, "Sorry, not sorry." The thing that Baker has long suspected happens in ladies' rooms has happened. The truth has come out.
"I'm going to miss you guys," Baker says.
Turns out that when Nanette's husband, Tony, lost out to Beanie O'Connor's grandmother in the auction, it lit a fuse. Nanette and Tony have a raging alcohol-fueled fight in free parking, though thankfully no one ends up dead like in that book all Baker's friends read 3 or 4 years ago. And Nanette announces that she wants a divorce.
"The auction was just an excuse," Debbie says when she comes over the next day to help Baker get organized. "She's been sleeping with Ian for years."
Ian is Wendy's ex-husband. Yes, true. Everyone knows this. Nanette sends Baker a text less than an hour later.
"I hear you have a place for rent?"
He texts back. "Just so happens I do." On Sunday, Debbie helps Baker clean out his fridge and cabinets. Becky helps him figure out his tax returns. Wendy comes over with her daughters, Evelyn and Ondine, and they play with Floyd while Baker packs Floyd's suitcase. Ellen stops by with a goodbye present, a Rawlings alloy baseball bat for his new coaching duties.
"You won't hit the ball if you don't swing," she says.
Baker books tickets for Wednesday. Debbie drives a minivan. She's going to take Baker and Floyd to the airport after she drops Eleanor and Gail at school. Monday after school, Baker and Floyd sit in the kitchen eating pizza because Baker doesn't want to dirty any dishes. It's ironic that they're eating pizza, Anna's favorite meal, when Anna is so far away. Baker decides to reach out to Anna. He snaps a selfie of himself and Floyd and the sausage and pepperoni pie from Brothers and texts it to her with the words, "Miss you, Mom." She'll probably respond to the text sometime next week, Baker thinks. A few minutes later, Baker's phone beeps and he checks it, expecting Anna's response to be, "Okay," or "Sounds good," or maybe even, "Miss you too." The text isn't from Anna, however. It's from Cash. Baker reads it, then drops his phone. Rosie. July 31st, 2006. I should have known that telling Mama and Huck had gone too easily. Mama read my diary and found out about Russell and found out about Irene. And one night after work, I walked in the door expecting to find her asleep or possibly waiting up with a plate of chicken, beans, and rice. She was concerned that I wasn't eating enough for two. But instead, she was in the doorway, my diary in her hand, her eyes popping. "A married man?" she said. "Have you no shame, Rosie?" I grabbed the diary from her. "Have you no shame?" I asked. I went into my room and slammed the door behind me, my heart cowering in my chest because I had left it exposed and my mother had found it. "I'm going to set the diary on fire," I thought, "and if the whole house goes up in smoke, so be it." There was a light knock on the door and I figured it was Huck, there to try and fix what my mother had broken. But when I opened the door, it was Mama herself. I tried to slam the door in her face, but she pushed back. For a second, our eyes locked, and it was a test of strength. I was younger but pregnant. Mama was Mama. Then she put a finger to her lips, and I relented. She entered, closed the door quietly behind her, sat on my bed, and patted the spot next to her. I shook my head, lips closed in anger. "I'm sorry," she said. "I had to be sure." What she meant was that she had to be sure the baby wasn't Oscar's. I wasn't naive. I knew there was talk across the island. Who is the father of Rosie Small's baby? The odds were on Oscar. It was possible that Oscar had even claimed it was his, though we hadn't been together since he'd been out of jail. "My word isn't good enough," I said. "It's not," Mama said. I gave her a look, which she brushed off. "You're young, you're afraid, you might have said anything to keep a roof over your head." "I don't need this roof," I said. "I have money saved." "Oh, that's right," she said, "the $10,000. Where is it?" She knew about the $10,000, of course. She knew everything now. Vi's Beach, the sex, the room service, the wife and sons in Iowa, the name of the boat, Bluebeard. "I kept $1,000 in cash," I said. "The other $9,000 I deposited a little at a time along with my paychecks." She nodded like she approved. "Good." "I haven't contacted him," I said. "I have no intention of ever seeing him again, Mama. Like I said, it was a mistake." "Your voice is saying it was a mistake, but your face is telling a different story." I almost broke then. I almost said that it wasn't a mistake, that I didn't regret being with Russ, that there had been something between us, and that something was real. But my mother was Catholic. She believed in the sanctity of marriage. A married white man having a baby with an island girl was no good. I could tell, however, by her mere presence in my bedroom that it was far, far better than me being pregnant by Oscar. "What does Huck think?" I asked. I wondered if he might be more sympathetic to my situation. He had been married, then divorced. He, maybe, understood that relationships didn't always fit into neat boxes, though it would be very unusual of him to battle Mama. "Huck doesn't know."
"You didn't tell him?" I said.
It was even more unusual for my mother to keep a secret from Huck. "I told him the man was white, a pirate."
Pirate had been the word I used in my diary.
That's the story from here on out, Mama said. Pirate came in on his yacht, you had relations, then he left, never to be seen again.
She clasped my hand. Do you understand me, Rosie?
Never to be seen again.
You see this man again? I phoned the wife.
Irene Steele from Iowa City. I called information. I have the number.
Hearing Irene's name come out of my mother's mouth gave me chills. I knew she was serious. I could never see Russ again, even if he did someday return. August 22nd, 2006. It was as though we'd conjured him. 3 weeks after my mother confronted me, I was at work, still cocktail waitressing, even though my belly was enormous and my ankles swollen, when Estella tapped me on the shoulder and said, "There's a man at the bar who wants an order of the conch fritters." "Isn't Purcell on the bar?" I asked. "He is, child, but this gentleman asked for you." I was punching in an order, and I had a table with food up and a table still waiting to order drinks, and Tessie was taking a leisurely cigarette break, as always, and I was about to snap. The restaurant was closing September 1st for 2.5 months, hurricane season, so I only had to make it through another week. I gathered my wits, delivered one table their meals, took the drink order, ran quickly to the ladies' room, and then, feeling relieved and refreshed, I lumbered over to the bar to see which gentleman at the bar wanted the conch fritters. Honestly, I didn't even think. Russ was sitting at the corner seat. I was torn between running straight into his arms and running for the parking lot. His eyes became round as plates when he saw my belly. He knew. Todd Croft must have told him. But maybe he didn't believe it, or maybe he was overwhelmed to see evidence of his child with his own eyes. "Mona Lisa," he said. "Stop," I said. "Mine?" he said. "Don't insult me," I said. I turned and gazed out at the water in front of Keneal, but I didn't see the yacht.
"Bluebeard is on Necker Island today," he said. "I came over in a helicopter. We have a client with a helicopter."
He seemed proud to be telling me this, like I would care about a helicopter of all things. "Must be nice," I said. My voice was stony, nearly icy, but my insides were molten. "He came back. He was here." As discreetly as I could, I checked his left hand, ring still in place. At least today he was dressed appropriately. He wore stone-white shorts and a navy gingham shirt, crisp and expensive-looking, turned back at the cuffs. A new watch, a Breitling. He had a tan, a fresh haircut. He had lost 20 pounds. He looked great. There was very little trace of the sweet, bumbling man I had known. I was even more drawn to this sleeker, more confident version.
"What time are you off?" he asked.
He nodded down the beach.
"I got our room."
Our room, 718. I had avoided going anywhere near the hotel room since he left. "I can't," I said.
"Why not?"
Why not? I thought about telling him that my mother had read my diary and was threatening to call Irene, but I didn't want him to know how much control my mother had over me. I thought he'd be angry that I'd written about our relationship and been stupid enough to leave the diary in a place where Mama could find it. I thought he'd think poorly of my mother for blackmailing me, and I couldn't bear that. Mama was looking out for me. "You're married," I said, "to Irene. You have children already. I'm not going to disrespect that. You can't ask me to. It's not fair."
"Rosie," he said.
"It happened," I said, "but it can't continue."
He nodded at my midsection. "Except it is continuing. You're having my baby."
I nearly surrendered to him right then and there. My baby. Here he was, willing to claim the child so that I wasn't alone in all of this. And in the months since he'd left, I had felt very, very alone. Mama and Huck would help me. I would live with them and bank the money that Todd Croft had given me to get me through the first year. "I have to get back to work," I said.
I left Russ and put in an order for conch fritters. He stayed until service ended. His mere presence at the bar, he was watching the Braves-Phillies game, made my pulse quicken and my breathing get shallow, and I feared this reaction would affect the baby, so I tried to stop and rest, drink plenty of ice water, and get to the ladies' room often to splash my face. Finally, I was finished. It was time for me to leave. I walked over to him. "I'm going home," I said. "It was nice to see you again."
"Please, Rosie," he said. "Just come to the room."
I wanted to, if only for the air conditioning and because I knew he would order me whatever I wanted from room service. But then it occurred to me that Russ might have been after sex and sex alone. Maybe he saw me as a girl in a port, an island wife. I was nobody's island wife. "No," I said, "I'm sorry. You're married." He nodded.
"That I am."
It pained me to hear him say it, but it also gave me resolve. "Please don't come back here," I said, "unless you get divorced and you have bona fide legal documents to prove it. It's difficult for me to see you." I spread my hands across my stomach. "I had feelings for you."
"Had?"
"Had, have, it doesn't matter because you don't live here and you aren't mine."
"I'd like to support the baby," he said.
"I received money already," I said. I wasn't sure if this would come as news to him or not.
He said, "Todd showed me your email last week. He told me he sent you money back in May. He told me he came down to Carnival in July and that he checked in on you and that his hunch was correct. You were pregnant. The instant he told me, I made plans to come down here. I'm here only to see you, Rosie."
Todd Croft had come during St. John's Carnival and had spied on me? I didn't like that one bit. Russ had found out only last week? "I have everything I need," I said, "but thank you."
"You don't have to forgive me, but you do have to let me support that child," Russ said.
"I don't, though," I said, and I walked out of the restaurant, past the sugar mill, and into the parking lot where I climbed in my car and cried. The following week, a package arrived containing $5,000 in cash. An identical package came the week after that, and the week after that. October 29th, 2006. Today at 5:09 a.m., Maya Rosalie Small entered the world, weighing 6 pounds and 14 ounces and measuring 20 inches long. She is the most beautiful creature I have ever laid eyes on. The nurse brought me a form to fill out so she could make the birth certificate. On the line where it asked for the father's name, I wrote, "Unknown." November 1st, 2006. Maya is 20 days old. Today, I sent an email to Todd Croft at Ascension, letting him know that I'd had a baby girl and that her name was Maya Small. September 4th, 2012. Today is Maya's first day at the Gift Hill School. She marched into the classroom, head held high, shoulders back, with barely a wave to me and Mama and Huck, all of us standing in the doorway watching her go. Huck had a charter, and Mama was due at the health center, and I thought, what am I going to do now? Then I realized this was the perfect time to start journaling again. Because if you don't write down what happens in a day, you forget. And that day becomes a blur, and that blur becomes your life. If I had to describe what has happened in the past 6 years, what would I say? I quit my job cocktail waitressing at Keneal and got a job waiting tables at La Tapa, but only 4 nights a week because of Maya. I have a best friend named Ayers Wilson, who's another waitress at La Tapa. She's like a sister to me and an auntie to Maya. She dates Mick, the manager at the beach bar, so we stop by there after our shift, and sometimes there are cute guys and a live band, and sometimes I dance and a date comes out of it. But there has been no one special because the first thing I say is that I have a daughter, but the father isn't in the picture. And the second thing I say is that I was born and raised on the island and will never leave.
This scares everyone away. Everyone. On the first day of each month, cash arrives in a package, and I put it in the bank for Maya. It's how I can pay for Gift Hill. I won't say I'm not grateful, but receiving the packages also fills me with anger, shame, and longing. Unbelievably, after all this time, I still think about Russ. I wonder how he's doing. I can only assume he's still married to Irene, trying in earnest to make the marriage work. I hope he's happy, because if he's not happy, then what's the point of staying with her? February 9th, 2013. Journaling is like exercise. It's hard to keep it up. You have to make yourself do it, and ultimately, I don't see the point of went to work, played Tooth Fairy, went to bed. Tooth Fairy because Maya lost her first tooth, bottom front left. It popped out when she bit down on a piece of breakfast toast, then it skittered across the floor, and Huck found it. I sometimes wish I had an email or a cell phone number for Russ. I would tell him, "Your daughter lost her first tooth." What would he do with that news? I wonder. He has no one to share it with. February 13th, 2014. Two things happened today, almost at the same time. One, I was on Salomon Beach, finally reading Eat, Pray, Love, the book that Ayers holds above all others. She has been to Italy, India, and Bali, so it resonates with her. Anyway, I was in the midst of the India section when I looked up and saw that yacht, Bluebeard, sailing past Salomon toward Kinneil. No, I thought. But then I remembered that it was this time 8 years ago that I met Russ. I stood up. I was wearing a white bikini, just like I had been when I met Russ at Hanson Bay. I wondered if Russ was on the boat and, if so, whether he could see me. I was tempted to drive to Kinneil to check if Bluebeard had anchored out front, but while I was in my car debating, my phone rang and it was Huck. It was mid-afternoon. This was very unusual.
"It's your mother," he said. "She's sick, and I'm taking her over to Schneider."
"What do you mean?" I said. "My mother didn't get sick. My mother was a nurse practitioner who, after years of treating everything from head colds to herpes, had developed a force field around her. Nothing got through."
"She's being admitted," he said. "It's her heart. It's failing. You and Maya should plan to come over and see her after school lets out. I'll handle today, get her settled, talk to the doctors, see if it's better for us to go to Puerto Rico or the States."
I could have told Huck then and there that Mama would never agree to be treated in the States, but I didn't want to start a healthcare debate. Her heart failing? It seemed impossible. My mother had the strongest constitution of anyone I knew, and that didn't even take into account her iron will. For years, I would have said it was impossible for my mother's heart to fail, because she didn't have a heart. March 3rd, 2014. My mother, Leanne Small Powers, died at home with Huck and me by her side. We'd let Maya have her first sleepover, an overnight with her little friend Joni. We explained the situation to Joni's parents, and they were very kind. We'll tell Maya in the morning. March 10th, 2014. My mother is dead and, now, buried in the Catholic cemetery. We had a service led by Father Abrams, my mother's favorite, followed by an enormous reception on Oppenheimer Beach. The community center was open, everyone brought a dish to share. The men got the grill going, my mother's friends sang some gospel hymns followed by some Bob Marley. There were children running in and out of the water and down the beach. It was as much a celebration of life as it was a memorial. When the sun set, the rum came out and a steel band set up, and once I made sure Maya was safe, under the watchful eyes of her aunties, I found Huck and he poured some Flor de Caña and we did a shot together.
"We're going to make it," he said.
"Are we?" I said. I knew it was the right time for me to find a home of my own. I had plenty of money in the bank to rent a nice place, maybe even buy. But I knew that if I moved out, my heart would break and so would Huck's. My mother was gone. We needed to stick together. I found Ayers and Mick sitting on the beach together, and I joined them and Mick's dog, Gordon. We were such good friends that we didn't have to speak. We could just be. Mick whistled, snapping me out of my daydream.
"Would you look at that?" he said. "Bluebeard."
I made a sound, words trying to escape that I caught at the last second. "Bluebeard?" I stood up and, sure enough, there was the yacht, cruising across the horizon in front of us. Headed away from Tortola, it looked like, and toward, well, toward Keneal. Where else? I stayed on Oppenheimer until the very end, helping to clean up until every trace of the celebration was swept away. Ayers and Mick offered to take Huck and Maya home. I wanted to stay there and hang out by myself for a while. They hugged me. They understood. They did not understand. Ayers was my confidant, but I hadn't even told her the truth. I feared she would tell Mick, and Mick would tell someone who worked at the beach bar, and the next day the whole island would know. Ayers thought Maya's father, someone I called the pirate, had come in on a yacht one weekend and then left, never to return. Ayers hadn't given a second thought to a yacht called Bluebeard. By the time I got to Keneal, it was very late. I still knew people who worked there, Estella, Woodrow, and Chauncey, the night desk manager. I knew that Chauncey had grown complacent at his job. Absolutely nothing happened at Keneal between the hours of midnight and 5 a.m. Chauncey slept in the back on a cot. I parked in the lot and sneaked across the property in the shadows, going past the sugar mill, the swimming pool, and tennis courts, across the expanse of manicured grass to a string of palm trees that lined the beach. Bluebeard was anchored offshore. Honeymoon 718. I stood in front of the room trying to summon my courage. If I knocked and it wasn't Russ's room, whoever was in there might call security. And what would they think, seeing me there? They'd escort me off the property, or they'd call the police, or... Huck. Maybe someone would know me and realize I'd just lost my mother. They would chalk it up to grief. The worst outcome would be if Russ did answer the door, and he had a woman in there. Irene. Someone other than Irene. I knew it was naive, but for some reason, I didn't think Russ would take Irene or another woman to our room. I stepped up and knocked. Nothing. No rustle, no voices, no footsteps. I knocked again, louder. And then I turned to look at the boat. Bluebeard. I could swim out to the boat, climb up the ladder at the back, ask for Todd Croft. I laughed. I was losing my mind. The door to 718 opened. It was Russ standing before me, blinking, befuddled. "Rosie?" he said. "Hi." "You're real? I'm not dreaming?" "My mother died," I said. "Today was her service." "Oh, Rosie," he said, "I'm so, so sorry." His voice was thick with sleep. I peeked behind him. The room was dark, the bed empty. "Can I come in?" "Yes," Russ said. His eyes filled, and I could see my own emotions reflected back at me. For 7 years, I'd told myself that staying away was for the best, that denying what we'd shared was for the best, that sacrificing this man was for the best. I had lived with agony, with sadness, with longing. I had been such a fool. I stepped inside. Part 4. Christmas Cove. Irene. Lydia sends Irene a text asking how things are going. Irene replies, "As well as can be expected." This is a flat-out lie. Things are going far better than could have been expected. It's unsettling, almost, how well Irene is adjusting to life in the islands. To start with, she loves her job on the Mississippi. She loves being out on the water. She loves the clients. She gets a rush every single time someone gets a bite. She has mastered stringing the outrigger and using the gaff. Huck has promised to teach her how to read the GPS and drive the boat. Irene bragged about her ability to fillet a fish, though Huck isn't ready to relinquish that duty yet. Still, Irene tried to buy a proper fillet knife on Amazon, but her credit card was declined, and a call to Ed Sorley confirmed that now that Russ was officially dead, her account at Federal Republic would be frozen until they sorted out his estate. Her account at First Iowa S&L in her own name is still active, but it has less than $3,000 in it. Just as Irene was about to fret, she received an email from Mavis Key asking where Irene would like her final check and year-end bonus sent. Year-end bonus? Irene thought. They never received bonuses at the magazine. It's a gift from Joseph Feeney, Mavis said, as a thank you for all your years of hard work. You built Heartland Home and Style from the ground up. Irene asked Mavis to send the check to St. John. It was $12,000. Irene still had $7,200 of the $8,000 in cash she'd brought from Iowa City, plus a check from Huck on her dresser. She decided to open an account at First Bank next to Starfish Market, with the Lover's Lane address printed on her checks. I'm becoming a local, she told Huck.
Can't be a local if you don't show your face around town, Huck said. Come to dinner with me tonight at Extra Virgin.
Irene declined. She wasn't ready. Against all odds, Irene loves the villa. She has locked the door to the master suite where Russ slept with Rosie, even though it's the best appointed room with the most dramatic views. Frankly, Irene would like to lop it right off the house, though this isn't an opinion she shares with the boys. The boys, Cash, Baker, and Floyd, have all chosen bedrooms, and Irene is comfortable at the opposite end of the hall, next to Maya's room. She thinks about redecorating the entire house. The decor now is functional but uninspired. It needs brighter colors, some original and surprising elements. It needs personality. Once Russ's estate is settled and she has access to some funds, she plans on turning the house into a tasteful, tropical dream home. Maybe when it's done, she'll pitch it to Mavis Key for the magazine's Escapes feature. Irene Steele, editor emeritus of Heartland Home and Style, opens up about redecorating the St. John villa that her late husband, Russell, shared with his mistress and love child. Irene also toys with the idea of turning the house into an inn, just as she'd considered with the Iowa City house in the minutes before she found out Russ was dead. What if she rented rooms free of charge to women who, like herself, had discovered a husband's infidelity or who, like her cousin Mitzi Quinn, had lost a husband and was having a challenging time bouncing back? Irene and these women could bond over iced coffee, papaya smoothies, and wine. They could gain strength from one another here in paradise, make it a sort of emotional convalescent home. Irene loves the idea, though she knows it will never come to pass. She enjoys having the boys here. They have developed an easy routine, and the house is big enough that they can all do their own thing without stepping on one another's toes. Irene is still Mother Alarm Clock. She rises before the sun and makes sure Cash is up in time for his charters. When Baker and Floyd went back to Houston, Irene was sad to see them go, but Baker assured her they'd be back the following week. Overall, Irene is far happier than she should be. It's not lost on her that ultimately this is because of Huck. He's a wonderful, kind, supportive boss, and he's becoming a better friend each day. Irene assumes that they share the same emotional space. They're still in mourning, still dealing daily with the shock of their situation. But because they are also mature adults, they soldier on. And then on Monday, the beginning of Irene's second week of work, things fall apart. It starts with the text that Irene receives Sunday evening about the next day's charter. It says, one adult,
2 children, last name Goshen, New York, New York,